So a very warm welcome to you all. Really nice to have you all here. How Buddhism Helps. It's a short course, 3 weeks, and it's based on a really fundamental teaching, a Buddhist teaching that draws together all of the Buddha's wisdom and practice and advice into three principal aspects. Because often when you first come across Buddhism, you have no idea where to get started and how it applies to our daily life. So this is just putting it all into a really manageable overview and a really easy way to get started practicing straight away. So you get the key aspects of the Buddha's path, the really big picture, and then everything else that you investigate, you can hook onto this, you know the context to put it into. So my task for this is trying to be a bridge between the Buddha's wisdom, really authentic Buddhism, and then contemporary life, day-to-day life. It's a bit of a chasm in between because there's a cultural difference, the terminology is something that we're not used to, and then we, as Westerners, can really miss out on this incredible store of wisdom that can really help us. So what we're going to have a look at for the whole course, how Buddhism helps. Okay, so how does it help? What does it help? Buddhism can help not just current problems. Of course it can help current problems and of course it can bring a reasonable level of happiness. But the whole aim of Buddhism is to remove all the causes of problems forever so that we can really become liberated or free from suffering. So not just kind of learning to live with a tolerable level of unhappiness or just making do or kind of getting lost in the consumer world, but really looking at the nature of our existence and what it is that we can do about our suffering and our problems and seeing how we can actually, if we remove the causes, then we remove the result. Remove the causes of suffering, we have a result of lasting peace and happiness. And Buddhism can, it's not just for ourselves, but it's for others as well. We can bring in this kind of ultimate benefit to others. One way that we can think about it is that we can, starting off by minimizing whatever damage that we do. Minimizing the damage that we do to ourselves, minimizing the damage that we do to society, so that we make sure that how we live in the world is sustainable. So that's kind of one side, the non-harming. And then the other side of things is to really make the most of the life that we have. And for that, we've got to look at the nature of our life and really appreciate what our potential is. Instead of yearning for somebody else's life or wishing things were different, to actually take up new eyes and look at what our potential is in this world. And because we often so easily focus on negativities, we underestimate what we can do and how to then help others and how to help others without burning out, without getting frustrated, without losing hope. And all of this kind of hinges on understanding our true nature, understanding the nature of reality, nothing less. Because if we don't do that, then it doesn't matter how sincere we are, things aren't going to turn out well. So this course, How Buddhism Helps, it's actually for Buddhists and non-Buddhists because it's just a way of presenting the world to help make sense of the world and then make the most of our amazing human opportunity. So just a little bit of background, Lungri Tungpa Centre, this centre has been running for maybe 35, 37 years, something like that, a long time. It was started by my mother in the early 80s. And so I actually grew up in Lungri Tungpa Centre. I was brought up a Buddhist, even though also being brought up in a kind of Judeo-Christian background, just in our culture. But when I left home and left school and I decided to just scrap everything and start from scratch. So I didn't inherit my parents' boating habits or religion or anything like that. I thought I'm going to go my own way. And slowly on my own terms came back to Buddhist philosophy, and then gradually to Buddhist practice. So in that kind of spate of time, when I left home and my mother kept on running Lungri Tumpa Centre, in the late 90s, then she died of lung cancer. And so I kind of inherited the centre and tried to step into her shoes to keep it going, feeling completely inappropriate about it, because I just spent the last 15 years, drinking way too much vodka, making circus costumes, trying to find my own headstrong way in the world. So it was a big culture shock to come back to the centre and try and keep it going. But I count it as pretty much the most fortunate thing that's ever happened to me, because I got a chance to really start beginning a proper study of Buddhism instead of just having Buddhist tendencies. And basically it just saved me from the life that I was leading, which was pretty colourful but wasn't necessarily bringing much benefit. So with that kind of background, I hope I'll be able to bridge some of contemporary life and then how the really profound advice from the Buddha's experience can help us, because I've found how much it helped me. So normally what we do to begin any class is to start with setting our motivation. It's one of the most important things to do, because why we're doing a class will determine how much benefit we get from it and how well it will turn out. So just kind of settling yourself, your posture, so that you're comfortable but feeling fairly alert. And a nice way to do that is to imagine that there is a fine thread of light running through your body from the base of your spine up through your body and out your crown, as if you're being pulled upwards from the crown of your head. And then that way your posture will naturally align, and you'll find if you're tipping one side or the other, front or back, and also if you're feeling a bit tired, you can feel that the weight of your body is supported by this thread of light, so that you have a nice balance between sitting up fairly straight and also feeling relaxed. So once your spine is straight, supported from your crown, then in particular let your shoulders drop. And if you're feeling really tense, like squish them up to try and touch your shoulders to the base of your earlobes, and then let them drop. And do that a couple of times, squish, 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 and let them drop. Take a couple of deep breaths, and we'll start with some questions, some internal reflection. And the first one is, do you yearn to make something of your life? Or do you have a fear of wasting your life? Do you have a hope for how your life will turn out? Do you hope for a good time and not a bad time? And so far, how has that turned out? How successful have we been at it? Certainly not through lack of trying, but we may not know how to bring about a good life or happiness within our heart. And then also reflect, do you have people that you care about and you wish you could help them? And maybe you feel quite frustrated or helpless that you can't help. and you have questions about the meaning of life, the big meaning of life questions? Do you often wonder, who am I? What am I doing here? So if you've had any of these questions or doubts or queries arise in your mind, it's a really good place to start. So we can think that our motivation for doing this class, investigating the nature of ourselves and our life, can be not just for short-term happiness, not just because we have various frustrations and difficulties, but for a really long-term benefit. And what's the biggest benefit that we can aim at? Developing our potential without limitation, becoming completely free of dissatisfaction and fear, and being able to help all others. So from a Buddhist point of view, that's that the biggest aim that we can have is to become emotionally free, liberated from all suffering and its causes, and help everyone else into a similar state of lasting peace and happiness. So why would we go for anything less? So with this sincere motivation and a spirit of inquiry, we can have a look at, we've kind of addressed a little bit about the help part of Buddhism. Now let's have a look at, well, what is Buddhism? So I have a screen share that we can get started with this one just to help. And it's the similar things that's in your notes. Someone actually asked His Holiness the Dalai Lama at a talk that he gave in Brisbane several years ago now, and he asked, is Buddhism a science? Is it a psychology, a philosophy, a religion? So how about hands up if you think Buddhism is a science? I can see all your hands. So does anyone think it's a science? Nope. Who thinks Buddhism is a psychology? Hands up. Nobody. A philosophy? Most of you. Okay. And a religion? A couple. Very interesting. So I found this a really interesting question, and the answer that His Holiness gave was fantastic and quite surprising, because the first thing that he said was, actually the basis of Buddhism is a science. It's a science of the mind, of our experience in the world. It's a very sophisticated model of how the mind works, how we experience the world, and how we relate to the world, how we're interconnected, and how this whole process works, how we make our own reality. So just like we have in Western science, the tradition now in Western science is outward focused. It's focused on physical things that we can measure with physical instruments. And it's very difficult for Western science or Western medicine to investigate the nature of the mind and experience, because it's a different thing. It's not, the mind has no shape, no form, no age, no gender. You can't measure it with those physical instruments. But nevertheless, we can still take a scientific approach. And so the Buddhist approach is to really investigate how our emotions and our thoughts and our experience functions, and how we are not separate from the rest of the world, how we relate to the world. And the technology, the sophisticated technology that we use, because we're investigating experience, we're using our mind as the technology. So we're using our ability to concentrate, our ability to reason, to draw conclusions, And that is the sophisticated technology. And for this, Buddhism is really advanced, just as Western science is advanced with telescopes and microscopes and all sorts of things. When we get to, on the Western tradition, the investigations of quantum physics and of neuroscience, you know, the investigations of the very, very small, there is a parallel, but that it becomes very close between what Buddhism explains the nature of reality and how Western science is trying to come at it. But, you know, that's from I suppose, Schrodinger onwards, and that's not the kind of general understanding that we have of Western science. We're kind of 100 years behind in the West. So from this basis of a science of the mind, a science of existence, out of that arises an ethical system. So that is because not that it were imposing an external morality onto things, but because we understand how we exist in the world and how we're interconnected and what we do affects others and others affect us, then naturally an ethical system arises from that. It's a natural response. So it's universal understanding of how we live. It comes from recognizing interdependence, that there is no objective reality. That's just a fiction. Even from our Western point of view, it's a fiction. How the observer, when an observer observes an object, an observer interrelates with it and changes it. So we've proven that on a scientific external basis. But from terms of our experience, it's fundamentally important. Because we all have feelings, we all matter. And we can't ignore that. Ignoring that, you know, how human beings think and feel and interact with the world, it really matters. So this is where compassion fits in. And when we live in a culture that's based purely on economics, for instance, compassion is seen as an added extra that we only do when it's convenient. But we kind of forget that compassion is there really necessary at a fundamental basis, because who needs it is human beings. It's kind of similar to, you know, when the Native American Indians, you know, they said, you can't eat or drink or breathe money, can you? So we can't take ourselves out of the equation. So we have a natural ethical system that arises. And then out of that comes what I call ritual expression. So all of the various meditations and practices and the art behind me, that is a way of integrating our natural human creativity. We use all of our senses, our love of music, our love of beauty, to put our understanding into practice and mold our reality so it becomes the very best one, the very, very best way to help others. You know, the natural human need to be able to tell stories. Dot points, you know, as you know, they're not enough. You need to have a real feeling for it. So the religious aspect from a Tibetan Buddhist point of view, you may not understand what the meaning is in there. It may just look like ritual, but there is a huge depth of meaning, and it comes from this scientific understanding of the world, the inner sciences. So you don't really have to become a Buddhist as such. You can take it on whichever level that you like, a psychology, on the level of ethics and psychology and understanding how our emotions function. You can take it on a philosophy of how to live in the world, as a science, understanding the nature of reality, or as a whole experience, a religion, the ritual expression that puts it all together. You can take it at your own level and see how it works. So how does Buddhism help? We've got the three, renunciation, bodhicitta, and correct view, as the way to I suppose, approach our life and how to live a good life. Put them into bite-sized pieces that we can easily digest. And what these three aspects represent is reality, which is correct view, the work for oneself, which is to do with renunciation, and the work for others to do with bodhicitta. And we need all three, and we need them working coherently together if we want to achieve the happiness that we instinctually yearn for. We need all three if we want to be able to help others, those that we love and care about, but also everyone else, you know, because how we respond to others affects them and how they act affects us. So we can't ignore them. If we want to solve global problems, we need all these three. If we want to heal the climate, we need all these three. So really briefly, then the renunciation, the wish to become free of cyclic existence, the cycle of suffering, of the interminable ups and downs, of everything changing all the time and never feeling ready about it. So renunciation is translated as definite emergence. And it's represented by a lotus. So no mud, no lotus. And the amazing thing about a lotus is that when it arises out of the mud, none of the mud sticks to it. Actually, the petals, the way the petals are atomically constructed, it repels dirt. So this is kind of representing the nature of our mind, that even though we're completely covered in muck and mud of daily existence, we can arise out of that and our mind is unbroken. It remains by nature pure and clear, unsullied. So there is a recognition within the Buddhist framework that our nature is fundamentally pure and clear. And all of the problems and confusions and everything, it's like all the mud that's just contaminating it, but it's not one with it. And so therefore we can remove all of suffering, all of the causes of suffering. The second one, bodhicitta, compassion that is unbiased, so no favoritism, and it's more than just empathy. Compassion is an activity, and it has within it this taking on a responsibility for the welfare of others. So normally what we find that we have compassion, but it's just called common or mere compassion because it's usually just for those that we recognize as suffering or those that we care about. And we don't really have any compassion for people that we don't know. And it's very difficult to have compassion for those that we don't like or who are harming us. So actually our compassion for our loved ones can lead to violence because it's biased. And if we just care for those that we're close to and we don't care for others, when the others harm us or we perceive a harm in some way, there'll be nothing stopping us retaliating and harming back. And that creates all of the violence and confusion in the world. So if we want to stop this kind of violence, we have to develop a compassion that cares for the strangers and for the enemies, that takes their reality into account and seeks to help everybody. If we have favoritism of any sort, it's going to create, in the long run, more violence and more hatred. So this bodhicitta, a great compassion, it's a very difficult one to develop, but it's absolutely essential. And it also gives us a sense of agency and power back again, because instead of just feeling empathy and our heart going out to others and then just feeling helpless and hopeless and then shutting down and burning out, it recognizes, because we're all interdependent, that there is something that we can do to help others and that we have to, because how we are affects others. So we have this responsibility, and that actually gives us back our power. So universal compassion. And the third one, correct view, is understanding how we all interact together. So it's a worldview that's based on interdependence. And if we have this understanding or this wisdom, it can remove, it naturally removes all of our anguish, all of our confusion. So it's represented by the sun, the rays of the sun that illuminate darkness, that eliminate fear. And bodhicitta by the moon, like the cooling rays of the moon. So today we're going to have a look at the wisdom part. So we're going to start at the tricky bit, the hardest part. Understanding the nature of reality, no less. So how things exist. We're going to have a look at three levels of how things exist to be able to see how it relates on something really easy and quite a fun example, and then how it relates to our own experience, our self-image, how we feel about ourselves. And then we've got a hypothetical. We're going to figure out how old you are, because you might know how old you are. You might think, oh, I know, you know when you had your birthday, but I guarantee you at the end of the class, you will not know when to celebrate your birthday. In fact, you could probably celebrate your birthday many times over. So hard to believe now, but it'll be very interesting to see what you reckon at the end. So let's have a look. Root cause of all suffering. Let's cut straight to the chase. And so the Buddha pointed out that the source of every single one of our problems, our confusion, comes from not understanding who we are, what we base our identity on. We don't even think we're basing our identity on something. We just are confused about who we are. We make many, many assumptions and projections without even knowing it. And there is the big mistake. The big mistake is that we think there is a real me. There is some essence of me in here somewhere. And it's not just an intellectual thought. It's an instinctual grasping that there is an essence of me. And even though we have this really strong idea that there is a real me in there, when we start to look for it, we can't find it. We can't pinpoint it. It's just like shifting sands. And in fact, it's not just us, but throughout all of human history, no one's been able to discover this real, independent, autonomous me. Even though that's how we feel. So this is like, it's called counterintuitive. We feel one way and yet the reality is quite different. Now, why this matters is that if we want to stop suffering, if we want to stop being fearful, having anxiety, being bored, being restless or dissatisfied, we've got to stop this mistake, because this is the root of that. All of those problems, all of those experiences. So, confusion about our nature causes the three major disturbances of our personal world. Just a confusion of just not knowing what to do in life, not knowing how to make a decision, not knowing what's right or wrong, not understanding what's going on or why we feel like we do. And out of that, because we don't know and we just grasp at the nearest thing, we have craving. We're trying to solve our problems by getting things from outside of us. Constant craving. And when that's threatened, then we have hostility. So we have this kind of mistaken self-image. And because of that confusion or mistake, we become very, very sensitive, kind of heightened. And then we're hostile to anything that causes us pain or wounds our pride. And we have longing desire that can never be satiated. So if we want to stop all of those things, we've got to stop this root cause, this root mistake, which is a mistaken idea of who we are. Otherwise, we're going to be constantly acting under the influence of disturbing emotions. So Lama Yeshe, in that book, The Essence of Tibetan Buddhism, so he says, from the Buddhist point of view, having renunciation of cyclic existence or having loving kindness, these alone are not enough to cut the root of ego or the root of dualistic mind. By meditating on and practicing loving kindness, you can eliminate gross attachment and feelings of craving. But the root of craving, desire, the root of attachment, the root of hostility is ego and the dualistic mind. So therefore, without understanding non-duality, it's not possible to cut the root of human problems. It's like this example. If you have some boiling water and you put cold water onto it or ice into it, you can calm the boiling water down, but you haven't totally extinguished the water's potential to boil. So this wisdom is like being able to take the pot off the boil. Instead of just constantly having to put cold water in there, let's just solve it at the very root of the problem. So let's have a look at just really quickly the theory of it, and then I'll give you some nice juicy examples. But we've got to set our parameters right. So we've got this kind of recognition that all phenomena, which means ourselves and our world, exist interdependently. So we don't exist in a vacuum. So it means who we are depends on how other people respond to us, whether they acknowledge us or not, appreciate us or not, how they speak to us affects how we think and feel. Whether we like school or not, whether we like our job or not, whether we think it's a good job or a bad job, it all depends. It exists interdependently. So this is its kind of conventional nature. And the conclusion we draw from that means that ultimately all things are empty of existing in an independent way. They're empty of existing in an unchanging manner. So this word emptiness comes up a lot in Buddhism, and it's empty of something. It's not nihilistic. It doesn't say we don't exist. It doesn't say our feelings don't exist. But what we're saying is they don't exist in this particular way of being independent or unchanging. They're not solid. They're not concrete. They're not autonomous. They all depend. But when we're feeling them, we totally forget that. So the way that we can remember, appearances are not the reality. How things actually exist. So if we take an example of the three levels of dependent arising, if you take a leaf or a bunch of flowers, the obvious one, here they are, they come from causes and conditions, don't they? There was the seeds that grew them, there was the soil, there was the weather, whether they got bugs on them, whether they got burnt by the sun, all of those things, causes and conditions. They don't just come out of nowhere. And this gives us a lot of power, because if we recognize everything that we experience is a result, then necessarily it had a cause. Then necessarily, if we find the cause, we can do something about it, including all of our emotions, all of our thoughts and feelings. So that's one level of existence, that things come from other things and they're always changing, disintegrating, coming into existence, disintegrating. And that's a natural thing. And yet, even this really basic level, we find it really hard to grasp, because when things change, usually our response is, oh no. The next level is things depend on the parts which compose them. So, you know, all the atoms and the nucleus and blah, 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 if you look really closely into that leaf. Also parts or ratios of time, past, present, future. But mostly things exist by imputation or name, meaning that we name them. By naming them, we bring them into existence. The mind that conceives of something and gives it a name, a label. So let's have a look at an example. I've got a different screen share for this special one that I got up for you guys, because often people will say, oh yeah, well, seeing is believing, and what we see, that's how things are. But I've got this great example here. See this picture? So this is how we can see how things don't exist in a vacuum. They depend on their context, their parts, how we perceive them and how we name them. So what do we have here, this picture of two, looks like, say, typewriter keys, two buttons. And what do they look like? It's a white one and a grey one. Am I right? Do you reckon that's what it is? I can't see anyone nodding.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yes, okay. So now, and you think, okay, that's how it is. And if someone was to tell you they're the same colour, would you believe them?
No.
Yeah. No, that's right. So this is, we see something, we believe the appearance, and then we grasp at it as true. So now what I want you to do is hold up your finger, close one eye, and hold your finger so that it obscures that dividing line between the two colours. It obscures that horizon line. Now, are there two colours? What do you see? Do you see a grey and a white, or do you see two light greys?
Two light greys.
It's amazing, isn't it? So one way, when you have the context, it looks like white and dark grey. And the other way, aha, they're both the same. So which is it? It all depends, doesn't it? It depends on what we're focusing on. There's something very profound in this. I love all these optical illusions because they prove to us how they're in this little microcosm, how our mind works, and it gives us the key of how to liberate our mind. So it's a very simple one here of just grasping at appearances to be the reality. And we forget that reality doesn't exist in a vacuum. It exists in a context, just like this illusion. And when something happens to us and we feel really bad or we feel really good, we just think that's true, that it's reality. But it exists in this context, and that context is changeable. So that's one example. I'll give you the other one. Where are we? Here it is. So here's this story. A few years ago, there was a teacher that went out to, I think, one of the schools in the Northern Territory, and he was teaching the kids up there and, you know, ask everyone, draw me a kangaroo. And so there's a photo of a kangaroo. We all kind of know what a kangaroo looks like. And you might kind of think, oh, okay, most people will draw something like this, depending on how good you are at drawing or not. So most of the kids did draw something like that. But one of the kids drew that. Probably not as quite as detailed as that, but a whole lot of dots and squiggles and things. And the teacher's like, oh, you know, that's really nice, but I asked you to draw me a kangaroo. And the kid's going, I've drawn you a kangaroo. And the teacher's going, no, that's not a kangaroo. I want you to draw me a kangaroo. And the kid says, oh, you want me to draw what a kangaroo looks like. I have drawn you a kangaroo, but you want me to draw the appearance. So actually, you know, what the kid drew, that one on that far side there on the left, he drew the kangaroo within the context of the life cycle of a kangaroo, of how, where the kangaroo goes and eats, where the water holes are, the ancestral beginnings of a kangaroo, the whole function. So when you're looking at that level of the, of what a kangaroo is in the context of time, from ancient times to now, of what a kangaroo means, it's so much more than just the appearance. But it's quite difficult, isn't it, that if we just want to do the shorthand of a kangaroo, if we look at that, if we're not educated, we just see dots and squiggles and a whole lot of complexity. So normally when we draw the appearance of something, we think that's it and we grasp at that appearance. So I like this kind of middle one because it shows both ways. It shows the appearance of a kangaroo and also all of the function and the life history and the ancestry of a kangaroo. So to get through life, we kind of need this little shorthand, draw me kangaroo, there it is, so that we can focus on other things. But then the problem is that we grasp at that image, oh, this is a kangaroo, and we think that's it. That's all the reality is. And we miss out on this other profound depth. We miss out on the context of things. So we miss out on the real deep meaning in our life. We miss out on the connectivity between us and our environment, being intimately involved and connected. So the result is, for instance, we just feel alienated, lonely, alone, when actually we're surrounded by others all the time, just not physically, but they're there in our experience. So it's quite profound, this kind of instinctual urge that we have to just grasp at appearances. That in itself, the appearances isn't the problem, it's the grasping at them and thinking that's it. That's where the problem comes in. So where it comes in and creates a lot of suffering is when we're trying to figure out who we are. Who am I really? And what we do is we mix up ultimate and conventional reality. I'm just going to get all of these pictures up now. And that appearance, like the appearance of the kangaroo, because it's the first thing that we relate to, we think that's it and that's the essence of us. So when it comes to our experience, our first feeling of who we are, we think that's our core essence. And then we grasp at that. And then if anyone threatens us, then we hate them. And if anyone's nice to us, then we crave their attention. And it's all based on this idea or this feeling that there is a core me. But when we investigate that, we can see it's totally wrong, that it's a mistake. And because of that mistake, then all of our angst and suffering comes from that. Okay, so here's a little bit more from Lama Yeshe. So a person with some understanding of the correct view, or shunyata, sees that good and bad are relative. They exist only for the conditioned mind. They are not absolute qualities. The characteristic of ego is to project such fantasy notions onto yourself and others. This is the main root of problems. You then react emotionally and hold as concrete your pleasure and your pain. You can observe right now how your ego mind interprets yourself, how your self-image is simply a projection of your ego. You can check right now. The way you check has nothing to do with the sensory mind, your sense consciousnesses. Close your eyes and check right now. It's a simple question. Just ask yourself, how does my mind imagine myself? You might think, oh, I'm a bad person today because I was angry yesterday or I was angry last year. And you're still holding onto that angry or self-pity image of yourself. Your ego holds a permanent concept of an ordinary self all the time, this year, last year, the year before. thinking, oh, I'm a bad person or I'm not good enough. But from the Buddhist point of view, that's wrong. If you hold that kind of concept throughout your lifetime, you become a bad person because you interpret yourself as a bad person. Your ego's interpretation is unreasonable. It has nothing whatsoever to do with reality. And because your ego holds on to such a self-existent I, attachment begins. And because of attachment, hostility begins. So just in this kind of few split seconds of grasping onto this identity, this fictional identity, then all the rest of human suffering and hostility arises. So it's really worth investigating, who am I really? And if we want to come at to that really, the thing that we can grasp at is we are a dependent arising. It depends who we are. It depends the context that we're in. And actually, if you've ever been overseas or, I mean, you're at an alternative school, if you've ever been to like a straight school, you might find that you have a bit of culture shock. So culture shock comes from grasping at this idea of who we are, and then we change our context and suddenly nothing fits anymore. And it's not because of the culture, it's because of our mistaken idea of who we are. And so much of who we are is contextual. It depends on our environment. If we recognize that, then immediately that can become a strength. We're just naturally adaptive, naturally resilient. Things change and we can go with the flow without any distress. So we get more energetic, more happy, more content. If we grasp at this is the real me, and then, of course, feel really intimidated and set upon by others, that's what leads to fundamentalism, this kind of emotional tunnel vision. It's what ends up with all the riots that we're seeing at the moment from this grasping at this true identity and feeling intimidated. So we get this, we get the two mixed up, the conventional and the ultimate. And we, because we grasp at the conventional who we are, which is a product of our circumstances, for instance, but that one's always changing. So now, are there any questions before we go on? Does anyone have a question? No. So if we recognize that how we feel or how we think is not how we are, it's an appearance, and it's appearance to our mind, but it's not our ultimate core identity. So if we recognize that an ultimate me doesn't exist like that, it brings a lot of peace to our mind. And it gives us a lot more opportunities, because then we can decide on an attitude or an approach that's going to be the most realistic, that's going to bring the most happiness and contentment in our mind. It's kind of hard to think that how we interpret ourselves actually is based on a decision, but it is. So Lama Yeshe, this beautiful quote, if we truly wish to achieve the satisfaction of complete fulfillment, we must find a way to break free from the tyranny of ordinary appearances and conceptions. Usually that kind of low self-esteem identity that we have. Although we all have a fundamentally pure nature, it's not easy to get in touch with it. We need to quiet all distractions and loosen the hold of our ordinary appearances and conceptions have on us. We need to create space so our essentially pure nature can function uninterruptedly. So what I'd like to do is a meditation now, so we can get an experience of this. And the contemplation is to figure out who I am really. Who are you really? How do you interpret yourself right now? So whether you want to do this meditation with your eyes closed, or whether you actually want to write the answers down as we go through these various questions or interpretation, it's entirely up to you. But try and have your focus really like you're using your internal technology of your concentration to look at your mind and your experience. And so we have an idea, oh, this is me. This is who I am. But how much of who we are is based just on our gender, whether we're male or female? So if you think of your own life now and you imagine having gone through everything that's happened to you in your life, but you were the opposite gender. So if you're a guy, what if everything, all the same things happened, but you were a girl? How would things have turned out differently? If you're a woman and you've gone through various life experiences, maybe gone to work and experienced the glass ceiling. So what if all of those things had have happened, but you're a guy? Would you have been treated differently, had different opportunities? Maybe if you've got siblings in your family and the boys are treated differently from the girls. So just think how much of how you respond and who you are is just based on gender. If you're transgender, then how much of your whole experience is dominated by just trying to carve out a piece of territory for yourself that isn't binary? So that much of our identity is based on our experience of gender. So let's just put that aside, because that's a circumstantial thing and can change. So it's not the real me, right? So we put that aside. Now, what about age? How old you are, but then how old do you feel? And sometimes when things happen to us, we're transported way back to when we're a little kiddie. I've often asked people, you know, how old are they? Oh, I'm in my 40s. How old do you feel? About 18. And if you're young, then how people treat you, they might condescend to you. They might, disregard your decisions or your opinions. So how much of your experience is just bound up with how old you are? So put that aside. That's a circumstantial thing. It's not the real you. What about race or culture? You might identify as being Australian, or you might identify as being Middle Eastern or Greek or Italian or Serbian or Croatian or whatever it is. Many immigrants identify with the old country, but when they go back there, they've got an Australian accent. We might, you know, if you're Serbian or Croatian or Macedonian, you might be at odds with each other. But if you form a soccer team together, now you're one. So put aside race or culture. Because that also is circumstantial. So then what about family life? How much of our identity is based on our role in the family? But your role might be that you're a child in the family, but if one parent dies or leaves, you may have to take on their role. And now suddenly you're the mother or you're the father doing that role. If you're growing up children and then they leave home, now who are you? Your whole function's changed, like the empty nester. So our role within the family also is changeable all the time. So put that aside. What about career or occupation? So much of who we are is bound up with what we do. So if you put aside what your status is, your job, then what about how we look? So if you're rather tall, imagine if you'd gone through your whole life as being really short. Would you be a different person now? Or if you're really short, imagine if you'd gone through your life being really tall. So much just the size of our body determines how people respond to us. If you've got a really big body, people often think you're really strong. If you've got a really little body, people think you're really frail. Not necessarily so, but how everyone relates to you then changes how you are. So put aside how you look, the size and the shape of your body. So what's left? How do you interpret yourself right now? So if there's anything that is left, then ask yourself, is that changeable as well? So what we might come back to is what's left is just bare experience, we're a living being, we're a human, but even then, more fundamentally, we're a living being with feelings. And actually, that's the same as everybody else, not different. So we have this idea, this feeling, this is me, different from everybody else. But all of those things are changeable and do change. They're circumstantial, and we put them aside. What's left? This is me, a living, feeling being. And this is the same as everybody else. It's what we have in common. It connects us to others. So we don't exist in the way that we first appear to us, to ourselves. And when we grasp at all of those distinctions, it creates a barrier between us and others. If we recognize, who am I? really, there is this deep equality between us and all other living beings. So just take a moment to let this reflection settle deeply into your experience. And dedicate your efforts to being able to use that experience to create harmony around us and connectedness with others. And then you can open your eyes, and hopefully you found that a useful contemplation. Are there any questions or comments that come from that?
I just found it really, I think you're right, when you actually go into that and let all of those things, push all of those things to the side, there's like this peace that kind of just descends on you, like it's a feeling at the end of that. Yeah, I really appreciated it.
Yeah, because so much of our experience of being alienated or intimidated, lonely, you know, feeling unsupported, all of that experience, which is very, very common, comes from feeling separate to others. And, you know, if we actually get below all of these circumstantial layers, we find this natural connectivity with others. And then when we go out into the world, other people aren't enemies anymore because they're just like us. And, you know, all the hostility in the world really comes from focusing on those differences and feeling it personally, like that's a threat to me. And, of course, it's a threat to me, because if the me that we're grasping at is that ever-changing circumstantial one, there's nothing there to grasp at, so everything's a threat. So this fundamental mistake that we make, I mean, it's a huge human tragedy, really, because it creates all of the hostility in the world. But it's a really easy mistake to make. So the whole point of Buddhist investigation is to investigate how we actually exist and how we don't exist, and get it really clear, because everything else, all the other, the peace and the love in the world flows from that understanding. So so things do not exist in the way they first appear. So it's okay to have this conventional idea of who we are, you know, a person at work or a person at school or whatever it is, a woman, a man, all of those things, but that's just the conventional layer, and it can change. It all depends. So let's get to the one of how old we are, because you may think you know how old you are, but even age is what's called a dependent arising, which means it depends. It depends on causes and conditions. It depends on its parts, but mostly it depends on name, on imputation, the label you give it, what you decide on. So let's have a look. So the first question, when were you born? When's your birthday? So we kind of might have a date. But actually, and that's just a convention, that date, because when we start looking closer, it disappears. Because do we count how old we are from when we're born, from when we came out of the womb? Usually we do. But actually, technically, if we do that, then that means the whole time, the 9 months that we're in the womb, we were minus. We were minus a month or minus 2 months. If we just start from zero, from, you know, when we are born, then what about beforehand? We're not counting that. So actually, you know, the Tibetans, they count your age from conception. So you're already almost one when you're born. because they take that into consideration. Don't you find it amazing that we don't count those 9 months? They're like, they're a negative number. But even then, if we're going to count from conception, how do we know when we were conceived? Was it this day or that day? We've got no idea. Nobody has any idea. They just have a rough idea. So right there, we can't even say how old we are. When were we born? Then we can also ask, well, how do we actually measure how old we are? So we think a year, for instance, it inherently exists. We think a year is a year and that's it. But actually, this idea of linear time, it's just made up. In experience, how we experience things, when you're like 5 years old, a year feels like forever. And this is because a year is a ratio. It's 1/5 of your life. It's a huge amount of your life. When you're 80, a year just goes by in a flash. Why? Because it's 1/80th of your life. It's so short. So it's a ratio. And as you get older, time goes by faster because of that, how we experience time. It goes by faster because a year is a ratio. It's not a self-existent thing. Not only that, how do we measure how old we are? Well, we can be 80 years old and feel 60. We can be, 16, 17 year old and wake up tired and feel about 50. Many people in their 20s, 30s, 40s still feel like a teenager the whole time, up until when you get old, so-called old, and then you just end up on funniest home videos, all the old people doing things that they used to do when they were young and falling over and hurting themselves. Why does that happen? Because they feel a different age from what they actually are, and it catches them out. Also, someone, if you're intellectually disabled, you may have a mental age of a 12-year-old, but you continue to age. So that's why we have to put a caveat in there. Oh, they're 35 years old, but they have a mental age of a 12-year-old. So even then, the measurement, it has exceptions, doesn't it? What about if we use a different calendar? So what about if we use a lunar calendar and we've got 13 months? Or what about if you had an ancient Roman calendar where you only had 10 months? Then how old would you be? Totally, a totally different number. Then you can go, well, what are we measuring? So when we go, how old are you? I'll say, 40 or 50 or whatever it is. But actually, when we're looking at what we're measuring, our lungs, for instance, our lungs are about 7 years old. Within 7 years, all the cells in our lungs are replaced. So I might be in my 50s, but my lungs are seven. They're slightly damaged from when I was a smoker, so, they're not replenishing themselves perfectly, but they're only 7 years old. And so this means that, if you're a smoker and you give up smoking, within 7 years, you've got new lungs. It's amazing. Our skin. So how old's our skin? I don't know. How long does it take for all the cells in our skin to replace themselves? Our stomach. I'm not sure. I think it's quicker than our lungs. So our stomach is a different age from our skin. And not only that, but our hair and our fingernails, well, they're dead. So there's a part of us, our body, that's dead already. So how old's that? Finished. Dead. Our eyes, I think our eyes are a different age as well. And, you know, then there's those poor kitties with progeria that their body ages so much faster than everybody else's. So you might have a 10-year-old kid and, you know, you might have seen them running around and they've got like a body of a – they're a 10-year-old girl or boy, but their body looks like an old person. They've got grey hair and it's fallen out and all their skin's wrinkly. Their bodies – the cells of their body has aged much quicker than everybody else's. So, yeah, you can say they're a 10-year-old, but actually their body is a body of an 80-year-old and they have arthritis and they get tired and they've got brittle bones. So what are you measuring? Depending, well, you can go, okay, well, my lungs are having their seventh birthday and my stomach's having its fourth birthday and my hair's already dead, so it's going to go in the grave and whatever. How old are you? So it's all circumstantial, isn't it? It depends on the parts. It depends on causes and conditions. But what's really interesting is it depends on mere name, how we identify with how old we are. That is the deciding factor on how old we are. So one of them, I mean, you know, many people are surprised when they figure out I'm like 53 because I don't necessarily act it. That's been a bad thing for a while and now it's become a good thing. That all depends as well. But there's this amazing study that they did with these people in England. They got these people out of an old people's home and so they're all in their 70s or 80s, something like that, and they put them in a house by the sea, the 1960s house or the 1950s house. And they had all of the furniture from that era. They had all of the music, the records from that era, the various cocktails that they used to drink, and all of those, that style of clothes. And they got these old people that are there on their walking frames and feeling all, you know, decrepit and like no one respects them enough. And they shoved them in this home together, 10 or 12 of them. And after about 2 weeks of them listening to the music from when they were young, eating the foods that they were having from when they were young, dancing, those crazy 50s, 60s dances, wearing those clothes, what happened was these old people started standing up straighter. A couple of them started having a few affairs. The walking frames were gone. They started dancing. Their whole outlook on everything changed. They felt literally years younger and started acting that way. So, you know, the change in circumstances triggered a completely different interpretation, not just an intellectual one, but a whole experiential one, to the effect that it changed their health, that their arthritis and things got less, all of these things profoundly change their experience. So that's, it kind of shows us that what we identify with, that is the deciding factor. And if we identify with old and limited and no good, that will become our reality. And that what we think is real, actually there's so much more room to move within the physical limitations that you would think are insurmountable for an 80-year-old, everything changed. So how old are you really? It depends. So the answer, how old are you really, is there is no really. And we want a really because we want certainty. But there is no certainty like that. It depends. So this is what's meant by age is a dependent arising. So you have causes, conditions. How old you are depends on what time you were born, when you were born. You know, if you're twins, one's older and one's younger, even though it's like split second difference. It depends on your genetics, how quickly you age, whether you have progeria or not. It depends on your mental age and on your physical age. So all of those things determine a different age It depends on parts. So the ratio of time that you're measuring all the different organs. I'm going to have a birthday party for my stomach tomorrow and a birthday party for my eyeballs the next day. The other thing, of course, is that everything in our body is made up of the elements, isn't it, from the periodic table? Carbon, hydrogen, all of them. So those elements and the various heavy metals within our body, all of those, they're actually billions of years old. If we're looking at the molecules, the elements that make up our body, they're billions of years old. They come together with all of these causes and conditions to make up a human body that's this particular age. But actually what makes it up, we're made of stardust, literally billions of years old. So how old am I? Well, it depends which eye I'm referring to, doesn't it? So basically it depends on imputation, how old we are. When we investigate, it just the age of who we are really, it just disappears. So what it mostly depends on is how we interpret ourselves, how we identify, our state of mind, our associations, and how we interact with our environment depends on it. So we even know that if someone is quite condescending and treats us as a child, within a few minutes we'll start acting like a child. If someone shows us respect, within a few minutes we'll start respecting them. So we're so reactive to our environment. It's how we identify. So what this all means, this dependent arising, that when we're investigating how old am I and we cannot find a definitive answer, that shows the emptiness of that object. So age does exist, but it doesn't exist inherently. There is a conventional age and we need it. But when we look for it, we cannot find it. So it's an interesting balancing act, isn't it? There's a tension there between our kind of intellectual grasping at the convention as being the real thing, and then when we investigate, it just disappears. The tension comes because we grasp at wanting absolutes. So why does it matter? It's important because how old we are determines when we can get a driver's license, when we can vote, when we can go to work, when we can retire. So we need to have the convention of age. We can't throw it out the window totally. But we've also got to acknowledge that there's a lot of room to move there, and it's not an ultimate thing. It's a conventional thing. We're kind of like on a spectrum of age, and it's going to depend. And so that then as our body gets old, we don't have to completely identify with that and think, oh, no, I am disintegrating. It's just our body. Really, whether we're old or not depends on our mind. And actually, the mind has no age. It's formless, ageless, genderless. It has no beginning. And because of that, we can always continue to develop. So here's a little bit from Lama Yeshe. So when you have a problem, another way of thinking about a problem, instead of this is a good thought, this is a bad thought, remember that in fact both types of thought are unified in having clarity as their nature. So this or that, their clarity is their nature. If I pour two glasses of water into one container and shake it up, the water looks disturbed, but the nature of the water from both glasses is still clean, clear. Shaking them up together doesn't turn the water into fire. It still retains its clean, clear water energy. So we have one convention, we have another convention. It's very tricky to pull back and recognize that clarity of it all depends. Lama Yeshe also says, according to the Buddhist point of view, there is no human problem that cannot be solved by human beings. Each one of you should understand this personally and encourage yourself by thinking, I can deal with all my problems. I can solve my problems. This attitude is essential for your spiritual growth. Even though we may not be much good as meditators or spiritual practitioners, I truly believe that if we have some understanding and encouragement, we can all solve our problems. Most of the time, though, we fail to understand our own capacity. So we do that because we just grasp at the appearance, isn't it? We grasp at our ordinary appearance and think that's it. So hopefully you've got a little bit of insight into this kind of this approach, this rigorous analysis that you do to really understand our nature and our place in the world, and to pinpoint that grasping at a self and how that grasping is what causes the problems. If we can develop this wisdom, it's actually the only way that we can cut the root of problems. Otherwise, we're just putting cold water onto the boiling water all the time. It'll just help in the short term, but it won't stop the whole chain reaction. The main thing to take away from this is that if we recognize how fundamentally we have this equality, then we'll feel, on that fundamental instinctual level, we'll feel connected to others. And that way, for us, we'll never feel lonely or unsupported. But more importantly, for the world, it means that we won't harm others. We won't create hostility or aggression in the world. We'll naturally help others. We'll understand. And all of those things we'll see as not a bad person, but a person just like me, a living being just like me, acting badly. And if we can remember that, not just intellectually, but in our heart, we'll never create disturbance. We'll always be able to help. It's the only way to create a peaceful world is by understanding this, because otherwise we just get sucked into looking at people's bad behavior and just assuming bad person because we believe the appearances. It's so ingrained in us. So this kind of approach means we start having a much clearer mind. We're much more relaxed. We can read people better. We can react to circumstances in a much better way. Have a clean, clear mind. And from in the long term, we can actually eliminate all of our problems, all of our suffering, because they too exist in this interdependent manner. They too depend. And there comes a stage where whatever problems arise, you don't even see problem. You just see, wow, how fascinating. So it has a very profound effect on our life. If you've got the worksheets there and the meditations, that's the homework, is to be able to fill in the self-reflection sheets and do that meditation, that one of asking, how at this moment do I interpret myself? So even then, just that way of separating out your feelings, how you feel about yourself from the observer, that in itself will help us overcome any problem. So they did this study with real little kitties about if they said, how are you feeling today? And they go, oh, I'm sad, or whatever it is. Or if they said, oh, how's Felix feeling today? The kid's name's Felix. And if they encourage the kid to say, oh, Felix is feeling sad, instead of I am feeling sad, the sadness wasn't as all-encompassing. So just being able to separate yourself out and just call yourself, oh, Miffy's feeling a bit low today. Or, you know, or Delaney's quite happy today. So, but especially with the problems that we have, if we can recognize them as an experience, how am I interpreting myself today, rather than how am I, it stops it being so overwhelming, so all-encompassing. And that's the little key to start this whole analysis, to recognize it all depends. And if it all depends, then we're just going to go with the most beneficial one. So for those of you that are coming back next week we're going to look at renunciation, which is far simpler intellectually, but it's also quite challenging to practice, because it's about how to not sweat the small stuff, how to not contaminate all of our good-heartedness, our good intentions, with kind of the worldly concerns of status and pride and craving and hostility and that real short-term view that we have. So how to not sweat the small stuff, and also how to really enjoy what we have. So renunciation, you hear the word, you might think, oh, that means I can't enjoy anything, but it's actually releasing this really distorted state of mind so that we get so much more joy out of what we have in life. We actually recognize what's there. So kind of based on what we did today of how discovering a way how to live in the world, then how to really enjoy our life, how to liberate our mind from this constant craving. So what we might do is dedicate the merits, which is dedicating all of this good energy. It's like signed, sealed and delivered, pushing save on the computer. And then if there's any questions, we can have those. But this is a kind of a Buddhist way of bringing everything together. Let's take a nice deep breath and let everything settle. Imagine all the words today as beautiful, radiant drops of light, like a summer rainfall, alighting into your mind. And feel these drops of light, each word, each little aspect of wisdom, as this continuous rainfall of light falling into your mind and illuminating your mind. Each drop like a seed of wisdom, a seed of realization, absorbing into you. Your mind becomes very spacious, light, relaxed. And feel that these seeds of wisdom are there for you to nurture and bring to fruition for your own emotional freedom and those of all others. May they grow into realizations and happiness, and may you bring yourself and all others to a state of lasting, authentic happiness, completely free from suffering and all of its causes. And on that journey, may we create a harmonious world based on this wisdom of how we are all interdependent.